Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:38 PM. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is August 28th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I should also mention that it's a bank holiday in the UK on Monday, so we'll be taking the day off, and the comment of the day and the subscribers video will return on Tuesday. And I thought we'd kick off this week with the yield curve spread, and it's a useful indicator for a large number of reasons. The first is that it's often been referred to as the most reliable of all lead indicators for a future recession, and this was no exception. It did become inverted at the end of last year. In fact, the 10-year minus the 3-month became inverted, in fact, earlier than that. It was all the way back in August of last year. So that was a really very reliable lead indicator. Of course, nobody knew that we were going to have a coronavirus or a pandemic when it became inverted, but what it did suggest was that that we'd had a lot of tightening already, that the Federal Reserve had been engaged in simultaneous shrinking the balance sheet and raising interest rates. That was specifically designed to moderate speculative activity. It worked. They seized up the corporate bond markets in early 2019. Then they seized up the repo market in late 2019. That alone necessitated $500 billion in support. But it also kicked off this type of, or the way of thinking about the problems that might arise in the market and how the Fed might resolve them, because it has clearly stated that they are not imposing a standing repo facility, but the market certainly behaves otherwise. And even during the coronavirus pandemic, the intensity of the pullback in March and April did not result in the repo market seizing up. Now, we can, instead of thinking about this as a lead indicator for recessions, let's think about when do we get the biggest pullbacks during a recession. Well, that's another useful way of looking at the yield curve spread, because if we think about it, the yield curve spread, for example, became inverted first in 1998. It then also became inverted sharply in early 2000. It became inverted first in 1995, but then it pushed up and away from that inversion in 2007. So what we can then think about is that it's when it becomes inverted is the lead indicator. It tells us when the recession is going to occur. And then when it starts to surge up and out of the inverted condition, and then specifically through 50 basis points, that's usually when the stock market takes fright. So that was particularly the case in 2000. It was also a rather difficult time in the early 90s, certainly a very good example in 2007. Then we can also think about the upper side of this range. It's usually when it gets up towards about 300 basis points that we start to see lows coming into the market. That was in 2002, 2003. It was again in 2010, 2009, 2010. Even again in 2013, that was another significant low. So then when we think about what can we anticipate next? Well, it would be natural to think that following the inversion, we would have a ramp back up towards the 250 to 300 basis point level. Of course, usually what happens in order to create that big spread, it's the central bank moves in and cuts interest rates aggressively. Now, they have already cut interest rates aggressively, or as aggressively as they could, but they're at zero. Well, the Bank of England was saying in here today that negative rates are certainly part of the toolbox. So they're still talking about negative rates in the UK. The Federal Reserve in the USA has said that they're not going to go for negative rates. So in order to create that spread, what you would necessarily then have to have would be for a big divergence to emerge between the 2-year and the 30 and the 10-year bonds, which would only now be possible if people start selling the 10-year bond aggressively. Then that would create the spread. But a meaningful move in long-term debt, and particularly a move in the region of about 200 basis points, would create an additional $100 billion bill in terms of interest expense for the US government. Now, that far exceeds the $74 billion they spend on education a year. So it doesn't really look like something that the Federal Reserve can tolerate. Now, what they have said in here this week, and it certainly animated markets yesterday, was that they're moving to a new way of targeting interest rates and inflation. Well, they're looking at an average of inflation now rather than at aspiring to a 2% level. So what that means is that they're willing to overshoot on inflation. And that's an additional point, because it's again telling us what the market has already been behaving like. So everyone has pretty much assumed that the Federal Reserve is not going to be raising interest rates anytime soon, and yesterday they confirmed it. So we are going to have very low interest rates for as long as it takes inflation to rise above 2% and then stay there for a pretty sustained period of time. And that's something that could result in low interest rates well into the future. Well, that's highly stimulative. Now, then we have to start thinking about, well, what about the bond market? Well, I think the most important bond to pay attention to is the 30-year, because long-dated bonds like a 30-year are allergic to inflation. Now, what we have certainly seen was a very pronounced downtrend following the failed break above 3.25%, and that was at the end of 2018. Now we are steadying around the 1% to 1.25% level, and there's still a sequence of lower rally highs, and the yield is testing the region of the trend mean now. There is the potential that we are going to have inflationary pressure. When we think about the velocity of money, it has accelerated lower over the course of this year, and it has really been a profound decline over the course of the last 23 years. This price series peaked in 1997. So the buzzword of the 1990s, disintermediation, that removed whole stages of intermediaries where people would have taken a slice out of every transaction. And because that the demise of the interlocutor, the wholesaler, and retailers, and now you have much more streamlined supply chains where it is really just going from manufacturer to consumer with one intermediary in between. That has resulted in a massive decline in the supply of money. So anyone who is thinking about why have we continued to see the supply of money rising for such a very long time, well, that's the reason why. But we can also see that the supply of money has exploded on the upside this year, in direct correlation to the massive contraction in the velocity of money. And the size, in just literal terms, in fact, we would probably more correctly look at it on a logarithmic scale, but even on a log scale, we can see that the acceleration that we had in 2008 has been absolutely dwarfed by the size of the intervention in the market that we've seen this year. And you can do that without getting inflation, provided the velocity of money stays low. But if you get an economic recovery without taking that money out, then that's directly inflationary. Because the way that I've always described it in at the chart seminar is by taking the coffee cup and stirring, and then when you add more coffee in, and you stir at the same pace, well, then you're going to spill it. If you slow down, you can put more coffee in. As soon as you speed up, you spill it. And it is that spillover effect that creates inflation, where there is just liquidity sloshing around in the system. Well, the Federal Reserve has told us that that is exactly what they want. They want to create inflation. They are hell-bent on ensuring that that's what they get, and that means that as we get economic recovery, then we're likely to see inflationary pressures mounting. Now, it's very easy to think about the fact that we're in lockdowns right now, and there are an increasing number of stories about the reinfections. There was one in Hong Kong where somebody has been infected twice by the coronavirus. The second instance was really quite mild. Then we've just today there was another news story where somebody was infected in Nevada twice, but the second infection was worse than the first. We also have the fact that it's I think potential now that Europe is going to have a problem in Spain and France. But it is worth, I think, considering at least that one of the reasons why cases have risen in both Spain and France is because both of those economies are really very dependent on tourism. And it's just simply impossible to close down the tourist sector for the holiday season, because those types of businesses, they completely depend on the holiday season to fund their entire year. I'm from a tourist town, and there are a couple of the hotels, one of them in particular, it asks its employees to work 12-hour days, 7 days a week, for about 3 to 4 months of the year. But they also then pay them their full wages when the hotel is closed in the winter. So they don't pay them more in the summer, but they pay them an even wage throughout the year. That would be completely impossible if they miss out on the holiday season in the summer. Now, that kind of metric, that heavy dependence on a couple of months in the summer to fund the entire year, applies to a lot of the south of France and a lot of coastal Spain. So there's just no way that they can avoid having, or that they can do without that business. There's a rational reason for why we might have anticipated that cases would rise. It doesn't necessarily mean that cases will continue to rise as kids go back to school time, even though they're not going back to school. So I don't think that it's really, I think, accurate to call this a second wave. But we have certainly seen that cases are rising across Europe, and that's problematic. Now, one thing that I've also been thinking about is, well, what exactly is going on in terms of retail? When we look at, for example, Ross Stores, it was in positive territory in here today. I visited a couple of different retail locations in the last few days. Ross Stores is one of them. There was, I would say, the car park, at least in the one I visited, was half full, and there was plenty of people inside in the middle of the day on a Thursday. It was exactly the same in the Marshalls store close to where I live, and Marshalls is part of the TJX group. Marshalls tends to be the more upmarket part of the group. And there is a lot of people milling around in almost a furtive manner. They want to be shopping. They don't really want to be seen shopping. There is still a lot of uncertainty. Mrs. Tracy's business, we also went and looked at a vacant store. It's in an absolutely prime retail location. It's right on Hollywood Boulevard, on the Walk of Fame, and it's one of the most high traffic areas in the city. And what was interesting is that the other people competing for that space are looking to open food-related businesses, but they need to get permitting and that they want to sign a lease but not have to open or pay rent for a year. And that's why they even offered us the opportunity to take it over, because we wanted to open more of a straight retail location. They were hoping that we might open faster. The interesting point is that they haven't dropped the rent. The rent is still pretty comparable to what they were looking for ahead of the lockdown. Now, for prime retail and in a prime location, that's perhaps not so, I think, surprising. Because usually what you have with retail is that when you get a recession, it's the core holds up and it's the periphery suffers most. So we can certainly think about the fact that people are wanting to go out. They do want to socialize. They do want to spend money. They certainly want to get back to some sense of normalcy. One thing I've also noticed is that, for example, my tennis partner, he has been locked up with his small kids and family for the last few months. Orange County has just opened up, so they're taking a week off and going down to a resort in Orange County right as soon as the hotels open up. So we can also think about what we can anticipate for next year. When we think about the biotech sector, obviously it's really very worrying when there is reinfections and people getting sick twice from the same illness. That's the kind of thing that does damage sentiment. But I don't think we should really harp too much on sentiment, because the primary sentiment among the vast majority of people is they are desperate to return to their normal lives. And the biotech sector has the potential to deliver upon that. This week, Abbott Laboratories was permitted for a $5 at-home test kit, which is obviously really beneficial because you can hopefully get your results quicker. Now, that's the big problem with the testing regime in the USA so far. There's been lots of testing, but then you have to wait 2 weeks before you get your results, and that is ridiculous. That makes an absolute nonsense of the entire testing regime, because you will probably be either well under into your sickness, highly infectious, before you ever get your results. So this is obviously damaging. But when we then think about the fact that Moderna, for example, had quite positive results this week from the first part of its trial, that older people have been developing antibodies at a strong rate, that is really beneficial, considering that generally older people have a less of a strong immune response. Then they also tend to have the greatest mortality rate from the coronavirus. So that's a really positive piece of news. And there is the clear potential that we're going to have a vaccine towards the end of this year. They've even said towards the end of the third quarter. Well, the end of the third quarter is a month from now. So they are really anticipating some big news in the not-so-distant future. Of course, it's going to take time to get it out to people, and most importantly, it's going to take a massive public information campaign to convince people of the validity of these solutions, because it's a massive proof of concept test for the entire biotech sector. When we think about the incredible advances where you can use genetics and genetic editing to splice a small piece of the virus onto a cell and then teach the body to incorporate it and therefore develop immunity. That's practically, it's almost fairy tale like in terms of the efficiency. And it's also completely new, because You will remember that back in January, February, and March, there were noted experts saying that it was impossible to get a vaccine with inside of 3 years, whereas we're likely to have one in about 10 months. I think this is probably one of the best examples of those who know it best, love it least, they've been disappointed the most that we have in the current environment. If we do in fact get a vaccine coming through, then it's quite likely that people are going to surge back into their normal lives. There is going to be there's a veritable stampede of people to try and get back to a sense of normalcy, to get into social activities again, to pick up sports again, to get back into dance, to go to concerts, to go to the cinema, to go to every form of play and performance. And then there'll be an explosion of performances. You can think about all of the artistic people who have been locked up for a long period of time. They must be bursting with ideas about what they can do when it all eventually ends. And this is very comparable to, on the one hand, 1968, where we had this massive protests and then assassinations. And then in 1969, we had the Summer of Love. Then, and I do apologize, I said Thomas Cromwell instead of Oliver Cromwell in yesterday's broadcast, but following the puritanical reign of Oliver Cromwell, then we had the Restoration Period in the UK. That's where the King Charles dog came from, with the big hairdos and the opulence of the Restoration Court. So people were just sick to death of this puritanical regime. I mean, we have already seen comparisons to Footloose, the movie from, I think it's the 1980s, where dancing was banned. So this is really quite an extraordinary time that we're living through, and there is going to be a massive rebellion against it when they sound the all clear. And that is going to be acutely inflationary in the event that the Federal Reserve is actively targeting a higher inflation rate. So it's something that we certainly need to pay attention to. And that's why I was puzzled yesterday by gold pulling back, but it reversed the decline in here today and it finished close to the peak of the day. And I'm really very impressed by the fact that it has been able to continue to hold the $1,900 area. Silver prices were also in positive territory in here today and were not quite. Not up a dollar. In fact, it's been moving a dollar on repeated occasions over the last month, but it is now on the cusp of breaking this short-term sequence of lower rally highs, which is positive. When we then think about Bitcoin, it's another asset that had broken higher, has been in a process of consolidation, and it is still consolidating below the 12,000 level. But it has clearly broken through the 10,000 area. But what we're also now starting to see is more commodities moving. And I think this is much this is something that we do need to pay particular attention to. When we think about long-term charts for the grains and beans, soybeans is coming up to the upper side of a 2 year base formation. So that's, I think, a very clear upward dynamic that really stands out on the chart in here this week. Corn prices have done something similar. They're starting to firm within this range. And this is a range that's been going on now for 6 years. There are a substantial number of charts where we have these very long-term patterns of underperformance in the commodity complex right now. Wheat has got that same kind of rounding characteristic that we had in gold prices before they broke higher. But it's not simply the grains and beans. Arabica coffee has also been firming here, and it bounced this week from above the trend mean. So this is, I think, looking increasingly likely that the low is in. Then cocoa prices were also steadier in here today. This was a really quite clear upper dynamic. So what we're certainly seeing is that it is right across the boards. It's in the major commodities and in some of the minor commodities. For example, rubber is in the process potentially now of breaking its sequence of lower rally highs, and if it can sustain a move above the 200 level, well, then we are certainly back in a demand-dominated environment. In cotton, the price has also been steadying, and this again is another very significant global commodity. It hasn't quite broken the sequence of lower rally highs yet, but it is at least steadying from the region of the trend mean. And orange juice, which had made some of the early running because of demand for vitamin C in response to the coronavirus, is also now steadying from the region of the trend mean. Now, if we were seeing this in one commodity, it would be because of currency or because of crop failures or because of increasing demand. But we're seeing it right across the agricultural sector, and it's not specific to one geography, it's not specific to one crop, one weather cycle. So something is certainly moving in terms of the grain, bean, and agricultural sector. If we're another month forward from here and we see additional moves on the upside, well, then we'll have completed base formations in a significant number of these commodities, and then that's really representative of clear food price inflation. Now, obviously, that then has some of the most acute impact on poorer countries. And one thing that there are, of course, two reasons then why we might have this commonality in terms of the agricultural sector. The first is the dollar. The US dollar is trending downwards, and it was down in a dynamic manner in here today. So that is not quite a new closing low, but certainly testing the lows from earlier this month. So the weaker dollar obviously is an important factor in helping to support agricultural commodity prices. But then, of course, we have the inflationary pressures. The US dollar is falling for the simple reason that the US has been much more aggressive than the EU in supplying liquidity. So when you're willing to print trillions of currency more than your biggest trade competitor, then it's quite likely your currency is going to depreciate. So certainly the dollar is a factor, but then you have inflationary pressures too. Because all of this is occurring without oil prices. The Brent crude price is still hovering here around $45. When we think about the big inflationary pressures that started to come through in agricultural prices in the early 2000s and through into the middle of the 2000s, well, we had spectacular accelerations in companies like Potash Corpus Saskatchewan. I'm not sure if we can still get the chart for that, but and yeah, they've removed it from Bloomberg. But one thing that we know is that, and maybe we, well, I will try one more time and just see if the US listing for it is still available. Potash Corp accelerated in a profound manner between 2005 and 2007, but That was also in response to the rising cost of oil. So the big uptrend that we saw in oil prices from the early 2000s through until 2007, that was a contributing factor in the big acceleration that we saw in the prices of other commodities, because energy is such a massive input in terms of the production costs of just about all commodities. What we're seeing today is that commodity prices are moving across the board without oil prices rallying in a big way. So there has to be something else going on, that this is not purely about energy price appreciation, but rather it is about the devaluation of currencies. These commodities are rallying for practically the same reason that gold prices are rallying. The big difference is that people don't eat gold. They definitely rely on wheat, corn, soybeans, and rough rice as staple foods. Rough rice, in fact, is one of the only commodities that had rallied very profoundly during the early part of the pandemic and has since pulled back. What we're also seeing is that metal prices have clearly broken the downtrend. So it's not just one industrial metal, it's basically all of the industrial metals have broken their downtrends. So that extends from zinc through to copper. Nickel prices have also been choppy for most of the last few years, but they are stabilizing again, and we're in positive territory again in here today. So, in fact, if we look at the entire commodity complex, it's really energy is a big standout. It is the one commodity, a portion of the commodity complex, that isn't doing very well. Even if we look at, for example, palm oil, which is in many respects biofuel, it's also been rebounding in a really quite impressive manner and bouncing from the region of the trend mean over the course of the last few weeks. And it's been basing since 2012. So this is, I think, another example that there is something in the oil market that is holding it back. And of course, it's really about supply. So if we look at the total rig count for the USA, it's collapsed. But it collapsed about really from beginning in March and kind of bottoming out around June. And it usually takes about 6 months for that supply to have a meaningful effect. So when we start to think about, well, what is holding back oil? It's really that there is so much of it around. And we've had a big contraction in the global economy, so there's a lot of oil sitting around at present. But drilling has collapsed. Companies are not investing in new supply. Some are going bust. The really big companies, the oil majors, are in all sorts of trouble. And Exxon is still, well, at least steadying today from the $40 area, but there's no confidence among investors that the major oil companies are going to survive. I think that's incredibly short-sighted, but certainly we look at the outlook for the European sector in particular, then BP and Shell continue to make new lows, and part of the reason for that is Europe is much more aggressively regulating these companies out of existence. That represents a real challenge. They are going to have to reform, they're going to have to invest significantly, but they're going to have to do that in an environment where commodity prices are low overall. I think eventually we're going to get to a point where the surplus of oil will be eroded and then prices will rise. Then the rig count will kick back up again. I do think that companies like Exxon and Chevron are going to be able to consolidate and rationalize the shale industry, that there will be some significant mergers and acquisitions as a result of this bear market, and that the average cost of production for the US is going to decline, but quite how far it declines is very much an open question. I think it's likely we're going to see oil prices do better from here, not least because of the commonality that we have in the entire energy sector. But the other point, of course, is that we still have a lot of economic uncertainty. People are not willing to take bets. We've been having this debate in our own house, whether, even though we've been offered a prime location for retail, whether we should take it, because we just don't know what the outlook is going to be. Hopefully, the vaccines will work. Hopefully, tourists will return. But it's very hard to make these decisions without, in fact, having some evidence to build them on. And that kind of uncertainty is one of the reasons why people are not getting into oil at the present time. And they're also worried about the dividends. And even though companies like Exxon and Chevron have never gone without the dividend, and it's been decades since they cut their dividends, well, people are worried that they will cut their dividends. So I do think that energy is going to be an opportune area, particularly as we get past the US election. There's a massive uncertainty about the US election. One thing is that the Democrats are already talking about raising taxes, and they're talking about a Green New Deal. They're certainly talking about being heavier in terms of regulation on fossil fuels. So that's obviously a headwind for the energy sector overall. If that kind of administration does not win, then it should be beneficial for fossil fuels. It's already beneficial for renewables. Europe having agreed on a 500 billion euro Green New Deal has been like rocket fuel for the solar ETF, for the wind ETF. It's been fantastic for hydrogen companies. Siemens Gamesa is in the process of building the first dedicated solar, or excuse me, wind facility, specifically designed to produce hydrogen without being connected to the grid. So they don't have an interest in selling the electricity. They are much more interested in creating a high-value product like hydrogen. And this is the first of those types of scenarios. Now, we're in also a period of technological innovation. And the fact that we have got extraordinarily low interest rates is really profoundly beneficial for high-growth companies. And the Nasdaq has continued to push on to new highs. Now, it is definitely accelerating. There is absolutely no question of that. The logarithmic scale doesn't hide the fact that we have got a very clear acceleration, and accelerations are a trend ending. One thing that I am particularly interested in is the fact that gold is now outperforming, and that gold moved to outperformance in late 1999, bottomed in 99, started outperforming in 2000, right around the time that the Nasdaq peaked. We've had an incredibly impressive bull market in the Nasdaq since 2008, when it was trading at 1,000, and now it's at 12,000. So for the large cap index to go up 12 times in the space of 12 years is really quite incredible. And it's an incredibly admirable performance. So there is no doubt that these companies provide fantastic services. But there is also no doubt that valuations have increased and that they are extremely interest rate sensitive. So as long as interest rates are low and stay low, then that should act as asset price inflationary for all stocks, but particularly for growth stocks. We're also going to see a meaningful event happening over the next few days with Apple. The share is going to going through a 4-for-1 split, so the price is going to come down to 125. Now that has reordered the Dow Jones, for example, and that is going to make a health insurer the largest weighting in the index. Then we have to think about the fact that Tesla is going to go through a 5-for-1 split, and it's also trading with a $2,000 handle, but that's going to take the price down meaningfully as well. Now, of course, the charts are going to be repositioned so that it's not going to take effect in terms of the price action. But the reality, when we look at what's going on with these shares, it's very reminiscent of what we had in the late 90s, that the price of the shares was going up so quickly that companies just did stock splits in order to bring them down to more manageable levels. It's a reflection of just how much demand there is. Now, of course, when we talk about accelerations, well, Tesla has accelerated like very few other shares. It was at 500 in March, and it's at 2,200 today. It's really quite incredible to look at the financial analysis. They have cash of $8 billion, debt of $15 billion, revenue of $25 billion, and an enterprise value of $420 billion. So it's getting to a valuation that is really quite extraordinary. When you've got a price-to-sales ratio of 15, you have to start thinking that you're trading on an expensive valuation. But people are falling over themselves to own the share. And there is the potential that a lot of people bought in advance of the stock split, and there will be some who will buy after. But there is absolutely no question that this is very much gambling rather than investing. And when you get into the gambling portion of the market, then you have to start thinking that you're in the final stage. You're in the third psychological perception stage of the bull market, which is characterized by mania. And mania is tolerant of contradiction. And the contradictions that we see in the market today are everywhere. So Tesla can continue to go up. $500 a month is something that people expect when they buy it. And when they buy it 2,000 and it's at 2,200 within a week, well, then they feel like they're being vindicated. But it's literally impossible for a share like this to continue to rise in such a meaningful manner. There was an example yesterday where people using Tesla's autopilot feature, which is heavily hyped, slammed straight into a parked patrol vehicle. Again, not an ideal scenario. You also have the additional point that there is a lot of technology being promised. Solid-state batteries have been promised for at least the last decade, and there has been a 3-year lead time every time they've updated the new horizon. Well, there's a lot of companies talking about solid-state batteries for 2023, and we'll see if they are in fact delivered. Their promise of these kinds of batteries is that they will double range and greatly reduce charging times. So that's really attractive. But they don't exist yet. Dyson was thinking about and really got active in talking about building their own electric car because they thought that they had solved the solid-state battery problem, but they shelved the idea. So we'd have to conclude that they had not solved the problem. We have solar cells that are capable of 130% efficiency. That was announced last week. We have quantum computers that are moving on progressively in terms of power. Honeywell announced 2 weeks ago that they have now developed a 64-qubit quantum computer, which is the fastest in the world. The most important thing about quantum computers is that they answer different kinds of questions. So it's not like we're all going to be using quantum computers in our day-to-day lives tomorrow. But what it does offer is an additional tool for answering probabilistic questions. There is a philosopher called Leibniz, and he talked about the best of all possible worlds. And one of the things that he concluded eventually was that this is the best of all possible worlds because it exists. And it sounds trite, but it's a profound conclusion. And it's particularly relevant when you start to think about quantum computers, because what they basically utilize is multiple possible world theory. And in every instant, every other possible world is destroyed, and the one that is most likely comes into reality, and that's the reality in which we live. Well, it's the most perfect world because it exists. So quantum computers use that probabilistic method to come up with the most likely answer to a problem, and the accuracy of that answer becomes reality in every instant. So it's like a wave of multiple possible universes crashing on top of us, but is only one portion of the wave will in fact hit us, and that is the one that's most likely to exist. Well, these are the kinds of tools that can be used to answer probabilistic questions, and that's equally true of healthcare as it is of financial markets. And that is likely to form the basis of a secular bull market. It's the kind of thing that can create productivity growth. So, even though we have got certain portions of the technology sector which are really very expensive and have accelerated, we are still in a low interest rate environment, and we do have technological innovation that is accelerating. And the pace of innovation is exponential in nature. It's happening in healthcare, most particularly in biotech and genetics. Now we're also starting to see significant innovations in the quantum computer sector. Now, one thing that's interesting is that both biotech and quantum computers are accelerating at an exponential rate. So it is twice as fast, or in fact, it's a square of as fast as Moore's law. Of course, Moore's law has slowed down in terms of the production of semiconductors, and yet semiconductor shares continue to surge higher. The demand that we've seen for new computers and infrastructure to work from home, which is essentially replicating offices all over the world, is creating a great deal of demand for semiconductor infrastructure. It's also creating a lot of demand for customer relationship management software. So that's been particularly beneficial for Salesforce. Workday announced their earnings in here today, and the share broke higher. So those are certainly positive developments. And certainly, when companies start to look at the efficiency that they can gain from people being more efficient at home, there is certainly less talk around the water cooler. People who work on their own time then generally also tend to work more. One thing, oh, the best description of working from home that I've seen is you do not work from home. You live at work. And I think that's the realization that the majority of people who work from home will come to, that you will end up checking email, doing a little bit here, a little bit there, so that after a while you'll just end up working all the time. And that's basically what happens when you work, when you live at home, excuse me, when you live at work. That's probably something that will be attractive to some companies, but for other more collaborative enterprises, they'll want to get people back into the office. So we're in an interesting juncture where there will be change, and the gap between rich and poor is going to become progressively wider. Because in order to work from home, then you need to have a skilled job that can be done remotely. That's not applicable to at least half the workforce who rely on manual labor or soft skills like customer management and sales skills to earn a living. Well, that's extraordinarily difficult when people are spending the majority of their time at home. It basically ensures that we are moving towards debt monetization. The reality of massive debts and the outlook for, and I guess the trajectory of that debt means that governments have no choice. They have to pivot policy towards the majority, and the majority are inconvenienced and have experienced significant deterioration in living standards. That's the reason that we've had a populist revolt. The majority of the populist revolts we've seen so far have been right-wing in nature. They've been market-friendly. But the way things occur when the status quo has been broken is that first you lurch to one extreme, and then you lurch to the other. And that is now what is happening. It's already happened in Mexico. They've appointed a very left-wing administration, although not with a big majority. In the USA now, the Democratic Party is being moved progressively leftward by the progressive wing. It's not quite there yet, but it's going to intensify in nature. If the populations of the world are not placated by the willingness of right-wing regimes to perform massive fiscal deficits, and that still doesn't improve living standards, then they're going to go for even bigger deficits with left-wing administrations, and the revolt against the elite will just continue. It's just that there'll be a different focus on who the elite is. These are real potential outcomes. When we think about the US election in November, I personally think that the US Post Office is in absolutely no way ready to tackle the quantity of mail that a postal vote would entail. They're already under severe strain from absenteeism and then the surge of additional business that they've got from online retailers. The vast majority of Etsy and eBay businesses use the post office to send their items. Now, both these shares have been in negative territory this week, and this does look like a peak of near-term significance. Part of that lurch back towards the left from the right is for more regulation, for more censorship, more taxation, and more redistribution. And something that is currently affecting the online retailers is that there is another bill passing or moving its way through the California courts or the parliament, which would put the onus for responsibility in terms of abiding by regulations on their marketplaces onto companies like Amazon and Etsy and eBay. Amazon has been comparatively unaffected. In fact, they're supporting this bill because they know that their competitors are going to have a more difficult time complying with that regulation. And It's exactly the same kind of situation that the ride hail companies were subjected to. They were having regulation enforced upon them that each of their workers was an employee and that they would have to be responsible for them as employees. Well, that resulted in a significant deterioration in their business models. It also is representative of this increasing burden of regulation that is coming down on top of companies. And it's something that is going to have an impact on business. So when we then think about, well, what can we anticipate over the course of the next while? Well, inflation has got to be up there. The continued advance in technology is predicated on low interest rates. So it's going to continue as long as we have low interest rates and central banks that are willing to run the economy hot. The fact that the stock market is accelerating is graphic evidence that the economy is going to be run hot if it's not already running hot. Inflation will eventually force interest rates higher. We're starting to see commodity prices rising. That's a reflection of rising commodity inflation. Then, of course, we have the fact that housing prices have done spectacularly well, but they are incredibly interest rate sensitive as well. So, we are at, I think, a critical juncture. The willingness of the Federal Reserve to control the yield curve is obviously going to have a significant challenge. When we think about other countries that have tried to control the yield curve, well, the Japanese yen has been strengthening versus the US dollar for most of the last 5 years. In fact, I think it's probably better to look at it the other way around, where we've got this clear base formation. Now, the Bank of Japan has intervened to delay or to try and stop the appreciation of the yen, but this looks like a base formation on the cusp of being completed. So, certainly with Shinzo Abe retiring in here today, it's quite likely that the market is going to test the resolve of the Bank of Japan. They're so far not yet at a point where they seem willing to test the resolve of the Federal Reserve, but we are going to see whether this range on the yield curve holds. Every single time the yield curve spread has got up towards that 70 basis point level, it has been knocked straight back down. Well, it's at 60 basis points now. So we could quite easily find a new test of the 70 basis point level in the not so distant future. The bond market seems to be going one way, stock market's going the other. But the clear message here is from commodities that inflationary pressures are rising, and eventually those inflationary pressures become problematic. So it is certainly time to pay attention to inflation as a potential issue in 2021, and not least because of the end of the lockdowns and the resumption of normal activity against a very liquid environment overall. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.